Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective. They post episodes on Monday and Thursday mornings, bright and early. The latest one discusses players testing positive for COVID-19 amidst the league's plan to return down in Orlando. Be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective, as well as The Right Time, wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We have got a guest joining us on our episode this week. He is coming to us live from the great state of Texas. He is also from Texas. He's from Dallas, but you know, whatever. We let him slide all the way. Chris Bosch, what's going on?
Yo, what's going on, man?
I have realized really in like the last 2 years that I did not know how deep the Houston-Dallas rivalry like went into the core of my soul until recently for some reason.
What happened recently?
I don't know. I don't know what y'all did to get on my nerves, right? Y'all just a little different, man. Y'all just do things a little bit different up there.
What, in Houston or Dallas?
Oh, I'm from Houston. I'm talking about Dallas.
Yeah.
Our different is not y'all's different, man. Y'all still walking around with shags in the year 2020, man. Like, that's all I'm saying.
I have nothing to do with that, man.
That's what I'm saying. I will give you credit. You have never fallen into the trap of bad Dallas haircuts, right? You always created that distance between yourself and the city in that way that was necessary. But got you all because you are working on a newsletter now called The Final Chip, man. Tell the people about that.
Yeah, so working on a newsletter. We've been working on it for the last few weeks, few months. Yeah, I was inspired. We were all inspired. I think we were all inspired by the Bulls documentary, The Last Dance and everything, and just seeing how they kind of went in depth into these stories. I mean, I found it intriguing, and writing is one of the things I've been getting into over the last couple of years. I actually have a book in the works. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, all kind of happening at the same time. But we just figured like this newsletter would be a great opportunity to build an audience, to tell some stories. Something, you know, really just frankly cool that people I think will really, really enjoy. I mean, I think, you know, newsletters is one of those mediums that kind of get overlooked, and it's just this bite-sized pieces of information that can get through, and I want people to enjoy it weekly and just kind of go through the process and kind of take them in as much as possible so they could feel like they were there as well.
Well, I think a thing that hit me like really right now as we're talking, because I think with everything that's going on in the world, it's kind of thrown off the way that we do business in my industry, and we're like coming up on 10 years since you and LeBron joined Wayne in Miami, right? Like it's a legitimate 10 years since that happened. And I feel like in 20 years from now, we're going to have a hard time explaining to our kids, like what a big deal that all was, like what that, like that first year in particular, but just the idea that it all came together, like was just like, this is a revolutionary sort of thing that happened. And I wonder for you, when did you realize that, oh man, this might be even bigger than we thought it was?
Kind of like in the days after our celebration. We make fun of the celebration, you know, in good fun now. Hey, I don't take it back. We had a great time. But, you know, kind of seeing the backlash and how everybody responded, you know, to the decision and to, you know, that was like part one. And then to add injury to insult, you know, we started, you know, had our own little thing. It was a great time. But just seeing the response, those were the main things that kind of made me aware of saying, oh, okay, this is how it goes. This is how it is. People didn't like that, huh? You know, we were kind of in our own little bubble. And then you go outside in the world and be like, hey, guys, what's going on? No, you get the report and you might not like it too much.
And see, what I find, it's interesting to hear you talk about, you know, the celebration itself, because you're like, we had a good time at the celebration. But I still remember that clip of when you guys came up and hit the stage. Y'all might have been having a good time, but you were having a great time. Nobody looked happier to be there than you did.
Hey, man, look, let me tell you something, man. Like, for me, you know, the whole thing was surreal. I had kind of been dormant. My wife and I were dating at the time, and we were just pretty fresh in our dating world. We were having fun and going all over the country. And then the free agency process happened, and just all the way fun. And then, I mean, come on, I'm here in Miami with the possible greatest team ever assembled. And we didn't even have a team yet. You know what I mean? But, you know, for me, I was just so excited because I've been a basketball fan my whole life, and I understood what was going on and what was happening. So it was just everything unfolding in front of me live at that time. I always love to get the crowd riled up and, you know, just have fun, play to the crowd, man. That's always been my thing.
Well, for you, were you aware that this would also kind of be, I think, in a way, an introduction of you to a lot of people? And I say that because playing in Toronto, you're still playing in a different country, right? Like the TV deals are set up in a way where Toronto doesn't get a lot of national broadcasts and everything else. And it seemed, you let me know if I'm wrong here, in that summer preceding, we saw you at a lot of playoff games and kind of like you seemed more visible leading into that. Like you knew for you that this was going to be a change in lifestyle and everything else. Is that a fair read on things?
Yeah, I knew it was going to be a change in lifestyle. I knew that there was a small drop or a difference in the coverage in Canada, especially back then. You know, Drake was still on his mixtape grind, you know, so the popular genre wasn't paying attention to the city too much. It felt like our own little secret. And I mean, it was kind of frustrating because when I was, you know, talking with, you know, some of my friends, I wanted them to watch me. They couldn't watch me during the season. You know, I was under the assumption that people knew who I was. I didn't feel like it was an introduction for me. That was the case. Either way, it really didn't matter. I mean, I still had my goals and things I wanted to accomplish, but you know, it was a humbling experience for me in that sense.
And you were going somewhere warm because somebody told me in that process, and they were like, where do you think Chris Bosh is going to go? They said, it ain't going to be cold.
I heard he's going to Miami. I hadn't even made up my mind yet. The stigma was already there because, you know, obviously during the wintertime, my friends, they'd come back with tans and, oh, yeah, we've been in California. We've been in the Caribbean. We went to Miami. So, you know, automatically, like a lot of people were saying I was going somewhere and not cold. It wasn't even on my mind, to be honest with you.
It's always interesting to hear you guys say now that you're like, you didn't know where you were going because a lot of people really believe that in 2008, you guys made the decision that this was going to be the thing that you did. And I even saw when Dwayne put out his documentary, I was there for the premiere where he talked about how the night of the decision, he wasn't even sure what LeBron was going to do. And I looked at him, right? Like, I don't even know Dwayne like that. I just looked at him and was like, really? You didn't know? Like, for real. And he was just like, I swear to you, we were sitting at Prime 112, unsure that this was going to happen. So, like, what was the night of the decision like for you, wondering, because LeBron don't tell nobody nothing, like, wondering what he's actually going to do?
You know, we can have assumptions, and we can think we know what's going on, right? And we can think, like, okay, yeah, this will happen, and everything is going to fall into place. You know how, you know, LeBron and his guys are, they hold their cards up close to their chest, And so for us, I mean, we were kind of anticipating a party. We had the party scheduled. Don't get me wrong. I put the reservation in. We were there. We rolled the TV in. And then, you know, watching it is kind of, we got on the edge of our seat with everybody else. And then we eventually, you know, got the relief of him saying, okay, yeah, I'm taking my talents or whatever. It made us happy, automatically made everybody else not happy. But for me, it was just, we were just going 100 miles an hour, man. We were just like going from one thing to the next. I'm trying to, you know, get established in Miami. I'm throwing my own party. I know D had his own party. And then, you know, we watched the whole thing. But yeah, we were on eggshells a little bit until he announced.
And it's so wild. I watched the thing Don Van Nott is doing on The Decision. So I guess by the time people hear this, that will have already aired. And I kind of could tell at the time, but it's even more interesting now looking at The Decision and looking at how nervous LeBron was about like what all of this was going to be. And it's wild because I look back on it. I'm like, yo, that dude was 25 years old. Like all of that was happening and he was 25 years old.
For sure. And I think, and you know, I'm not saying it was a good or bad decision. That's, you know, that's not for me to judge. You know, him and Maverick Carter signing that $100 million investment into their media company. And essentially you could argue that maybe it started with The Decision, some, unorthodox sort of programming. It, has its place in history. And I mean, they raised a lot of money for, Boys and Girls Club. I think sometimes that can get lost in the wash a little bit. It was sensationalized so much to where, you know, people can forget that. But I think it was just an interesting time, man, and it had never been done before, you know? So anytime you're a pioneer in something, it's not always the best experience.
And I think an underrated part of this, you talk about, you know, we didn't even have a team yet when you put this together, is that fact. Like, you had three guys and no cap space, and you got to figure out how to put together a roster. And I've always wondered from the inside for you guys, Was that first year harder than you thought it was going to be?
Hell yeah. Look, man, Michael Jordan, well, he had that commercial when you remember that commercial when Mike said, maybe I've made you thought this was easy. We watched Kobe and Shaq, man. We watched three-peats. We watched Mike win six of them. You know, I mean, you see it and you want to get there and you know it's going to be hard, but you don't anticipate how hard. You don't anticipate like the reasons it's going to be hard because of storylines, because of maybe confrontations in the locker room, maybe, you know, just outside perception. Maybe you're going to get the best from every team every night while you're still trying to learn whatever offense we're trying to do. You know what I'm saying? We greatly underestimated the difficulty. We had our vision intact, but when the thing actually started while we're trying to gel as a team, you know, that made it extra difficult. And at the same time, you know, dealing with the fact that we're not that successful in the beginning of the season. And then you hear about it, you know, people can't wait to tell you how bad you are or things like that. And we just have to learn on the fly. That was probably the toughest part. But yeah, that first season, man, it was a tough one.
I remember I'm one of the few people who can say that in that first season, you guys actually exceeded my expectations. And the reason was I was just like, somebody got to run point. Somebody's got to play in the post, right? Like it's still a basketball team that has to be put together. And you were going to have to figure out how to be something I imagine that you hadn't been since maybe ever in your life, the third option. And like that adjustment process for you, because, you know, you're an all-star, you're a top five pick, all of these things that like you've been the best player on just about every team that you've been on. And now you're trying to figure out what to be on this team. Like for you, how much of an adjustment was it?
It was a huge adjustment, man. I mean, I kind of got into a mode where, you know, in Toronto, you know, if it ran through me, then it ran through me. I'm getting the ball on the right block and we'll work from there. That was pretty much the establishment of our offense. And then we went into pick and roll, usually in late game situations. I didn't know too much how to move without the ball. I didn't know, you know, proper spacing. I didn't know how to get the hell out the way sometimes, you know, and get to the open spot, you know. So that for me was like a huge, huge learning curve. Trying to do that under frustrating circumstances, it was difficult. You want to go back to your comfort zone, but I could not, you know. And, you know, it was learning. It was learning basketball, learning things on the fly. And for me, I have been in situations before like the USA basketball team. I had kind of taken it as a challenge to try and learn it. But yeah, there were those frustrating days and nights to where I don't know what's going on. I just want the ball in the right block. Is it helping the team? I don't know. And here's the crazy part, man. We watched Brian and D kill people on the block for years, right? Every time I got on the block, double team would come. And I just could not understand that. Brian and D, I mean, they could, boy, they could just camp out down there and take a nap. You know, with me, boom, double. And I never understood that. So eventually I had to incorporate myself into the game and help the team out.
And everybody was hating, right? Because the thing I didn't expect was how mad everybody was going to be about this. This never dawned on me. I was like, yo, this is the greatest thing ever. You don't want to watch this? Hey, man, f*** them dudes. I'm like, what?
Yeah, that was main thing that I underestimated. Nobody could have saw that coming because nobody had seen it before. I think, you know, probably the closest thing was Kobe and Shaq. And the closest thing before that was the Lakers, you know, Celtics rivalry. But that's a rivalry, you know what I mean? And then Kobe and Shaq, they were so awesome. You just had to throw something at them just to distract them for a little bit. This one was a little different. You know, we felt, I mean, you know, you feel attacked, man. And I mean, it is what it is. I mean, you know, now looking back on it, I'm glad we all went through it, but. Yeah, I mean, it was tough, man. I mean, you know, and this is, you know, usually, you know, I'm the dude from Canada. I'm like, hey, I'm from Canada. What did I do? Shut up. You know, for me, I made that move to be a part of a great team. I always wanted to be a great player. I told you who my heroes were growing up. It was surprising to kind of finally get there and finally get exposure to that U.S. market, and that was my exposure to the market. Everybody went from not caring to saying, 2.5 men. Like, what? How many more All-Star games do I have to get in? You know, do I have to average 35? You know what I mean? Damn, what do I have to do to even to get it to three men.
Yeah, well, that was the part that was kind of surprising, is that I think, like, you just kind of became the other guy, and the insults, a lot of them really were, like, tied to masculinity in a way that had to be a bit jarring and surprising.
Very jarring and surprising. And I mean, I had never, you know, had my manhood challenged before. That was new. You know what I mean? I was like, damn, I thought of myself as kind of a little bit of a ladies' man. I thought I was like the Marlboro man back in the day. Just the sign of a man. I don't know. I guess it was just something new, and everybody, it was kind of funny for me because, you know, the jokes and stuff were coming and all that stuff. Look, I come from Dallas, man. I went to school in South Dallas, Lincoln High School, man. We joked and roasted each other all day, every day. That was sport, you know, so I can take a joke, you know, so it never really bothered me. It was just, some were funny, you know, it would make me mad. I'm like, okay, that was a good one. The manhood stuff, that was the stuff that where I was like, okay, I mean, I don't get it, but we still had games to win, and I still had a job to do, so it really didn't even matter at the end of the day.
Now, a question that I've had, I really wondered about with you and LeBron with figuring out things in that first year was, how long did it take before y'all actually believed that Spo could coach? Because I know NBA players, y'all have to be won over by your coaches, and y'all can check out on a coach real quick.
For sure. You know what? Honestly, I think there's always a tension, and it's good. It's a good thing. I don't think we were like, okay, until we won. I'm pretty sure Spo wasn't like that. Okay, they can play, you know, until we won. The difficult things about it was, you know, just being open to the system. You know, I'm sure he was learning on the fly as well. And instituting the positionless basketball, you know, going back, I wish I could have dove more into the intricacies and the nuances to become even a better team. We could have definitely dove into the offense a lot more and the defense a lot more just to figure out how to become a better team. But for the most part, man, I mean, one thing I will give Spo credit for, he stays even. He's not going to change things up. He's not going to, you know, do things to appease people. He's going to coach. He's going to do his thing. He's going to stay true to who he is. He's going to implement the system. He's going to allow the system to fail him, despite if people are telling him he can't coach and Pat Riley should come back, which that was happening, you know, quite a bit in the first half of the year. Continue to coach and do his job.
And plus, y'all knew y'all wasn't going to be able to get him out of there, right? Like, Pat wasn't going for that.
Ah, look, of course we weren't. Hey, look, that was outside noise. We learned very quickly, hey, we need to just focus on what we need to focus on. This is all, you know, in-house stuff. Let's figure this stuff out. And Pat made that very clear as well in establishing the roles. He is the coach. You guys are the players. Let's go out here and do it. And that's, you know, that's pretty much, you know, the extent of it. We never let the outside noise inside the locker room.
When you got to that team, like, what did Pat Riley mean to you? Because you're a little bit of the age, like, you didn't grow up with the Showtime Lakers, you know, in that way. And so Pat Riley, I find media can often have a reverence for him that the players respect him, but they are of that time, right? So he means something different to them. So, like, when you guys got there, like, what did the idea of Pat Riley mean to you?
I mean, that was the first dude my dad was starstruck by, you know, and I didn't grow up with the Showtime Lakers, but I was in the house. I got all of that, you know, pretty much every NBA finals from 84 to 91. That 91 was when I started remembering basketball. I know he had me right by him. You know, I took in the spirit and everything. And my dad, you know, he told me, he was like, yo, that's Pat Riley, man. You know, and you know who Pat Riley is. I'm a historian of the game. It's funny how basketball works. I mean, you know, I worked out in Miami. I had dinner with Pat. You know, he took us out to dinner when I was a kid, you know, and it was intimidating then. But that was like my first introduction to him and getting to know him. And you know who he is, but the thing about great people, they have different auras, right? His aura is always going to have the slick back hair. Okay. LA Armani. Then you got New York Armani. You know, then you got the president. Okay. Then he steps down, goes right back to filling that presidential role. So, you know who he is, man. He's transcended time a little bit in different aspects of the game. So, you know, it's, you definitely knew who he was. That's for sure.
Yeah. Pat got all the game. I met him at Dan's wedding, right? I don't even know if he was actually listening to anything I was saying. And I was just like, nope, this dude got all the game. Like, he's just one, when you get into his space, you're like, nope, this dude got all the game.
Oh, you feel the aura. Feel the aura. You feel the greatness. And, you know, he just projects it, you know, consistently, man. I mean, there is, you know, I've learned so much from him and have been great to be able to call him a mentor, former business associate, but just going through all those things with him and actually getting the grand prize, it was great.
Now, let me ask you this about the 2011 season. Is there any, like, one thing that you wish you had done differently in the course of all of that?
No, not really. I mean, if I can nitpick, I would have gotten to space way more. I would have started shooting threes way earlier. I think, if I would have done that, that could have given us a couple more points, you know, to be maybe win another championship somewhere in there. But, you know, the game was changing and it was new at the time. And, you know, I was more of an inside presence and trying to figure that out with Dwayne and Brian, them two being outside, you know, inside presences as well. We had to figure those things out. But, you know, I'm never one of those guys to say I would have changed, you know, X, Y, and Z. I mean, you know, that's a small change I would have made, but, you know, it was a good season. We still, you know, we still made it to the finals. We still had a chance to win. You know, we just, you know, didn't play our best basketball. That was pretty obvious getting to the finals. You know, we got to the grand prize and, you know, the Mavericks played a better series than us.
How frustrating was it for you guys being great players as you are to see somebody set up in a zone defense against you? And it's working.
Oh, dude. Now that they had the game one. You know, it's just like watching that stuff. It's like, come on. I mean, we didn't run good offense. I think from top to bottom. And if you talk to every guy from the popcorn man to Pat to us on the court, I think looking back at that series, we all could have done a better job. You know, I'm sure the halftime crew would have been like, you know, if we would have played the music a little louder, you know, the dance team's probably like, you know, I didn't hit that move. The crowd, I don't know. It's crazy. I mean, just to, you know, watch that. Usually at that level, a zone gets just torn apart. But that's brilliant coaching by Carlisle. You got to give him credit, you know, to throw something unorthodox. Because I remember, you know, it was like a matchup 2-3. We hadn't seen that all season, you know, and then it's the finals and you're like insulted, but then the shot clock is going down. They continuously took us out of our element the whole game. And especially in game, what they were running in game 6 too, right? They were running that zone. Yeah, man, come on. I mean, I would love to talk about those guys because you just saying it. If I ran into Jason Kidd, I'm like, really?
Zone is for cowards. Like I adamantly, I'll take this. I sell t-shirts with that phrase. Zone is for cowards. And I just like after it happened, and I've been saying this for years. And every time I say it, they're like, well, the Mavericks used the zone against the Heat. And I will hate y'all for that very fact, right? Like that. I was like, okay, there you go. Okay. You got your one.
Look, hey man, you know, you can do what you want. Basketball, you know, the game is the game and it's on us. Break it down. And, you know, we didn't do it at the time. We were caught in the headlights. That taught us you have to be ready for all kind of, you know, situations in everything. You know, you never know what somebody's going to throw at you, but I will tell you that prepared us to be humble going until the job is done.
Now that 2012 season, it was the lockout season. You guys had a strong run through the regular season. And that's the year where you were injured in the playoffs with the abdominal injury. And I remember you came back from that abdominal injury shooting threes and you ain't go back to the block again. It was like you came out. It was like, why would I ever go back to doing that kind of work again?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much, man. I mean, you know, I told you I get double teamed and that's, you know, after wrestling with KG and you finally get the ball and then it's, you know, playing against a set defense, the whole defense shifts, you know, there's really no, you know, nowhere to go in the paint. You end up shooting a contested two. That began, I was able to kind of step back and see how I could contribute to the game. You know, once I came back, you know, it was all about just one thing. And so, you know, I was able to compartmentalize series by series and, you know, game by game. And, you know, by the time I came back, you know, it was game 5 of the Eastern Conference Finals. So we had a pretty good flow into what we were doing. It was just, you know, executing what we had to do.
And then there was game 7 in that one where you hit the 3 in the corner, right?
Yeah, I had three threes that game.
How big was that? Like, cause I remember that in particular, cause I was like, cause again, we had not really seen you shoot threes and he's coming out here and hit the big one, right? That was just like the shutdown one. Like how good? I mean, cause you've been through hell up to that, man. Everybody has something to say at all these points and there you are hitting that shot.
I mean, that's why it was so weird when everybody was like, okay, who is this guy? You know, this dude from Toronto. Ah, man, you suck. All the jokes are coming up. When these start happening, I'm like, okay, finally, things are back to normal. I'm supposed to be doing this. And I never understood, like, oh, well, how'd you hit the shot? Like, dude, I was wide open. I had been working on the three ball for a year up until that point. Hadn't really been aggressive with it. But, you know, through conversations with friends and stuff, a couple people just told me, like, yo, just step back, bro. Take two steps back and just shoot it. That particular day, I knew I was going to have a good game. I just felt right, you know, and my stroke felt good that morning. And I was joking with my good friend. We were sitting down, we're having lunch. I said, man, I'm not missing tonight, bro. And you know, we always just joke around. We've been knowing we play high school basketball together. So, you know, he's trying to hype me up. Be like, you ain't going to do nothing. You ain't on. What you talking about, man? Get out of here, man. You're growing hurt. I said, okay, cool. I just had that feeling that whole day. Time we got to the game, it was really nothing to talk about. It was just ultimate supreme confidence.
And then, you know, you win that series, you take it in, you get to play against Oklahoma City. You guys lost game one. It was a pretty, like, the Thunder put a wallop on in game one with that great shot of Pat and Zoe in the crowd, looking like Pat and Zoe just mad while everybody else is, like, super excited. You win game two, and then you brought it back home, and it didn't seem like it was tough work for you guys when it got back to Miami. Like, is this one of those series that guys often have where you just have a point early where you're like, nah, we're going to win this one?
We knew how it was, them being younger, them winning game one, because we were in that position the year before. We thought we were going to win it all. You win game one, and it's like, whoa, you let up. You know, because once we lost that game, we looked at the film, careless turnovers. All right, cool. We got back to it. I don't know. I mean, I know I felt I didn't want to come back to Oklahoma City. You know, Oklahoma City's grand, fine city. I just didn't want to go back. And I just felt like, yo, we're not coming back here. Monster at home. And we had the feeling once we get them in our arena, you know, we're not going to let them out. And you know, even with that said, I mean, game four that we had to come back from. But we knew that it was going to be a long series. We were in for it. You know, that's pretty much how, you know, we just saw the whole thing going. We had, you know, supreme confidence that we were going to get the job done.
How'd the podium feel?
It was like a relief. You know, man, one thing about the podium, they don't tell you, you're exhausted. You know, you just played the hardest game you've ever played and you're going through all these emotions and then my kids want me to pick them up and, you know, my son, he was like, you know, he was a small little baby. I wanted him to get that in and experience that and, you know, record that into his subconscious somewhere in there. You know, that was all that was important to me. After we got the job done, it was just like, you know, a nice relief to be able to say we accomplished something.
Now, what was that summer like, right? Because like on one level, you're getting ready for next year. On the other, you're enjoying last year.
Yeah, it's short. It's super short. So like for me, those next few days, you're just, you know, going to the next party. Someone else is having a party and you feel guilty because it's like, damn, Bron's having his party. Oh, B's having his party. Then they telling me about my party. Chris, your party's today. Damn. Hyde is throwing you guys a party. Damn it, man. But you gotta just go and parade, which was amazing. And then we went, my wife got me. She was like, yo, let's go. We went right to vacation. And, you know, I'm working out on vacation. You know, I'm kind of like, okay, you know, some band work in. Let me get on the bike. Let me, you know, just get the heart rate up, keep it going up. As soon as I got back, I can't remember where we were. I see Bron and he's like, oh, hell yeah, bro. I've been in the gym. I'm doing this and that and that. I'm like, damn. So it was never a moment of let up. You know, it was just continuous basketball.
And I guess you guys came back that next year and, you know, rattled off 27 wins in a row. Like, I think that's easy for people to forget in the course of that year. You won 27 games in a row.
That one just kind of happened, man. And once we got in it, you know, our goal was always to string together 10 games in a row, you know, to show that we were serious. As a challenge, a way to keep on track, you know, to the championship. and be able to compete for a championship. That particular year, the number one seed was very, very important to us, you know, so stringing together these wins were always, you know, at the utmost important. Once we got to like 12, 13, 14, it's like, okay, longest streak in the league. Yeah, hell yeah. And it just kept going and kept going and kept going. And then we had some amazing games to where, I mean, come on, we were playing terrible in the beginning, down 20 points in Boston, down 30 points in Cleveland. And we, you know, we came back and it was just these spectacular games and it had become a thing. And, you know, it was just like one of the layers on top of, you know, everybody was clicking, everybody was playing amazing. That was a lot of fun. You know, it kind of put us in a place of confidence. So it was necessary.
So in that postseason, the Indiana series, like for me personally, it stands out because in the middle of it, I moved to Miami. So that was its own sort of thing. But also I wondered for you guys, like, did you look up and expect that this would be a team that would push you to seven games?
Yeah, we didn't care for them and they didn't care for us. And, you know, they had their style. We had our style. Yeah, it was a rivalry. It was one of those games, you know, a fantastic team. They're a physical team. They play together and they want it. You know, they want to take us down. They want to win an NBA championship. You know, Paul George, they have their superstar. They were a tremendous defensive team. But yeah, I mean, we had their run in with them the year before last. We knew that they were coming back. You heard the speeches by Vogel. He was pretty pumped up too. He had his troops fired up and ready to go. And we knew it was going to be a tough series. And, you know, you get to the point of saying, okay, yo, whatever it takes, we're going to get the job done.
That series was over after game six. Once Roy went up to that podium and messed up, it was over.
What did he say in that podium?
That was when he dropped a no homo in front of people. Like, that's when he did that. It was, nope, this is over. Like, I talked to somebody in the tunnel before game seven. And they're like, how do you think this game's going to go? And he just looked at Roy and said, nope, this is over.
Yeah, he said that on the podium after a game.
And it didn't hit him. Like, what are you doing right now?
Yeah, man. Yeah, that was no good for him.
Yeah, no bueno. That was probably the better way to put it, right? Like, that was no bueno. And so this gets to one of the great NBA finals of all time is the 2013 NBA finals, against the Spurs. And so much was hanging in the balance with that series. People are talking about if the Heat don't win the championship this year, you're going to wind up being traded because they're going to need to shake things up and all of it. And it's 3-2. It comes back to Miami and it's the Ray Allen shot where you get the rebound. And the funniest thing always to me is that LeBron's over there like, yo, give me the ball. Give me the ball. Did you ever think for a second about giving the ball to LeBron over Ray Allen?
No, that was a very quick sequence. So the way I recall it is I grabbed the rebound and I didn't, if you look back at the replay, I don't look anywhere else because I grabbed the rebound and Ray is the first person I saw. You know, it wasn't much else to think about. You know, I'm not going to be selfish and try to dribble up and shoot so I could be on the poster. It's right there. And he called my name. You know, he was calling me. So as soon as I grabbed it, it was nothing else to think about. Saw him. I heard CB, saw him and, you know, it was just an automatic response. So, yeah, I mean, wasn't much room for error. And, you know, in that particular instance, if I would have hit LeBron, it would have been cross court. It was either a steal or, you know, that would have been the only shot at it. At least with Ray's shot, we could have potentially gotten another shot on the rim if he would have missed it.
That is that moment. My press seat was in like the 300s, right? They had me and Poppy way up high. And so it felt like the game might have been over. And so I wanted to get down, you know, to the court, you know, to be there for whatever wound up happening. So I leave from up. I'm going down. All these people are leaving the arena, right? They are jetting out as I'm trying to get down to a lower level because I got an all access pass. All these people are getting out. So I get down. I'm on like all the way down toward the floor. I'm trying to find somewhere to go. I was going to go in the tunnel, but they had just brought the rope out. Just in case the championship went. So I couldn't go in the tunnel. So I had to kneel. I was on the opposite side of the floor. I'm like on my knees in front of somebody trying not to be. And then the shot goes in and everything is different. Like I've never seen everything flip. And now you got all the people outside who wish they could get back in. They can't get back in.
Did you write your?
Oh, no, I was good.
Crushes Heat and Sixers.
I was lucky. I just had a pass. I didn't have to do no work. I was just in the building, baby. Like it was like the most mind blowing thing because it all flipped. Everything changed. And I remember I was in there, post game And as Ray, did you ever think about passing to LeBron? He didn't even let the sentence get finished. He was just like, nope, nope, nope. That was never a thought. Never, nope, nope, nope.
No, I mean, nothing ever really to think about. I think when you're in dire need, you compartmentalize everything. So it's not even, nobody is even in my head. You know, passing is even in his head. Out, rebound. Hey, Ray, shot. Boom, it goes in. Get back. You know, for me, I got back and I could hear Popovich, push it, push it, push it. So I got back quick. And, you know, they stopped the game. Then automatically, I'm like, okay, was it a three? Please, I hope it was a three. Okay, it's a three. Now we got to get a stop. Then we had to go to overtime. You know, so it was just an emotional roller coaster. We didn't have time. I didn't really think about it until after the game. But then even after the game, I was still kind of, I knew we were going to win it at that point because that never happens. And it happened in the NBA Finals game. And so just for the rest of the night, like, you know, we did our normal routine. We went out to eat and stuff like that. All the chatter was around me. All my friends were around me. But I was just kind of just, I was silent. And I was just like, do you realize, you know, I was trying to tell people, do you realize what just happened? I drew the line in the sand with a lot of people. I stopped talking to a lot of people after that. You know what I mean? Because if you weren't focused on winning after that, you couldn't talk. You know, somebody made a remark to my haircut because I shaved off the little boy haircut because I didn't want anything interjecting with my mental. Hey, cut it all off. I don't even want to think about it. Somebody said, oh, well, I don't like your hair. Why did you cut your hair like that? I was like, oh, okay, I'll never speak to you again. Did you just see what happened tonight and you're telling me about my haircut? Nah, get out of here.
And I think it's easy for people to forget. Game 7 was tight. Like, Tim Duncan had a chance. Like, one of the saddest things I've ever seen is Tim Duncan in one of those classic Tim Duncan $30 shirts sitting on that podium just dejected for how Game 7 ended and the shot that he missed. Like, I mean, if he were anybody else, it would have been a much more like captured and poignant moment because they were so close. And I think it was a layup that he missed late in that game. And you could see it like all over his face that he was there. But on the flip side for you, I imagine there was, as you said about the first championship, there was a celebration, but also a measure of relief because the stakes, at least from the outside, seemed so high for you guys in that game.
Stakes were always high. Yeah. I mean, different things happen. I still can't believe, I'm sure he got two shots at the basket. And if you go through that play, I love going through that play. We were scrambling. The reason, and Shane was on him, they played perfect basketball. You know, I think we went for a steal in the backcourt. I had to beeline it to Danny Green, who had the NBA record for the finals, you know, three-pointers. He's dribbling up. He's got the ball 30 feet away from the basket, so I beeline right to him. We scramble. Shane gets on Tim. They pass it down to him. Tim does the correct thing. He automatically goes. He knows his situation, read it perfectly. He goes to the old running hook. You're toast. It's over. You know, okay, he misses the bunny, then gets the hand on it. That usually goes in. You know, that usually, all you got to do is get your hand on it, and it usually goes in the basket. That didn't go in either. Game of inches, man. Even in that point, we still couldn't be relaxed or anything because we knew, like, hey, we were, you know, they had us by five with 20-something seconds left. Just constantly, constantly, constantly in it until the clock hit zero.
Now, how difficult was that 2014 season? Because Dwayne was injured a lot of it and we're trying to do so much to manage his knees and to get there. It just seemed that by the end, you guys had just run out of gas.
Ray's knee was messed up. Rashard's knee was messed up. You know, I mean, the Spurs were motivated. And I mean, that whole season, we didn't hit those markers to be a winning championship team. We got there. But to be formidable opponent against San Antonio, there's certain requirements you have to hit as a team defensively, offensively, in the locker room. And I mean, we just didn't have the spark. I think if you look back at the season, we were just kind of treading water more so as opposed to imposing, you know, everything. And granted, you know, the fourth season in a row trying to get to the finals and trying to win three in a row. Man, I mean, it's a lot of things. It's a lot of reasons why it's not going to happen. And, you know, mental fatigue, physical fatigue, wear and tear. I mean, it just all kind of came to a head. And like you were saying, the coach thing, you know, the coach might be tired of us. We tired of the coach. Same offense. Same defense.
Right.
You know, coming back in after that and getting back to the basics and having Spo be like, hey, man, you got to rotate. Those are the things that can get to you. You're a champion, but diving back into the basics can, it can be hard. It can be taxing and not everybody can do it. But we just weren't hitting the markers that year, just plain and simple.
And San Antonio that year was like a sneaky great team. Right. Like, I don't think they had a player that in that season, like Tim Duncan was great, but he wasn't a great player then. Right. Like Kawhi Leonard became great, but I don't think he was like a great player then. But the team itself was a machine.
I watched film. I've been watching film on that. Timmy was huge. You know how big Tim Duncan is, man. Playing up. And like, damn, CB boy, you're looking good. Boy, how much you weigh? I'm like, man, I'm up to 238, right? He's at like 255. Like, whoa, boy, Tim looking slim out there, man. Playing up. He's playing down and he's still massive. But just, you know, his greatness in the post, his greatness within the system of San Antonio. And then, you know, like they had Tim Duncan, Manu Ginobili, Tony Parker. You know, Kawhi Leonard, Greg Popovich, it's five Hall of Famers. They don't get enough credit. I think, you know, just because it's San Antonio, like a lot of people try to kind of mitigate the greatness of those teams. But, yo, man, they had very, very great players, you know, guys that are going to go down as the greatest of all time in their position. You know, it was just a dogfight. But that particular year, yeah, you know, Kawhi was coming into his own and he pretty much, you know, established himself as one of the premier players in the league that year. And, you know, he hasn't stopped since.
So how do you look back at that? Like we just said, we got 10 years since the beginning of it. Like, how do you look back at all of this? Because it really was an amazing, unique time in NBA history.
You know, the history of Cream, the British rock band back in the day.
Yeah.
Clapton, and I forgot the drummer's name.
Ginger Baker.
Yeah, at one point in time, I think they were grossing more money than the actual British government, you know, and they were only together for that long. I think that's kind of, you know, going to be our legacy. It was a 4-year show. You had to see it. It didn't end, you know, the way we thought it would. It just ended. You know, we played our last show and LeBron went on and kind of, you know, went their separate ways after that. But, you know, just the ride that we were on in those 4 years, it was, I don't think it'll ever happen again.
I will ask you one thing, because I realized I meant to ask it earlier, but I can't let you get out of here without asking this. What is the angriest that Mario Chalmers ever made you?
I think there's a clip of us arguing on the court in Chicago. And then like Joakim Noah, I guess he thought he was taunting us and separating us. That was how we talk over eggs and coffee. Me and Rio, we always arguing, you know. But that's the thing. Like, they don't hear what Rio says either. You know, they just see us reacting. You know, we're just not giving it to him. He was chirping back. That's why it always got so heated. You know, because you can tell, hey, man, yo, is Kobe, MJ, who's taking the last shot? He's going to think about it.
No. He's not even gonna think about it. The answer is Mario Chalmers. That's my favorite thing about him is that like he always like, I bet you have a friend like this. He's one of my best friends, right? Like I could try to talk to him about like what it's like being on TV and like dealing with strangers coming up to you. And he'll be like, dog, it's the same way when I used to party at the Bounce and everybody would treat me the same way when I would be out, right? Like that friend that is the star in every room they're in, no matter the context.
Oh, for sure. Rio will definitely tell you, well, I mean, we run high screen roll. I mean, I can make plays out of there. That's probably because everybody going to be worried about them and I can get to my shot. You know, we're trying to discuss rotations in live time and, you know, he'll let you know how he's feeling too. Like, well, you should have been over here. Everybody else is like laughing or thinking we're, you know, we could yell at each other on the court. Then afterwards, hey, Rio, let's go get something to eat, bro. Never, ever, ever. And even if we were yelling at each other, it was always from a place of, you know, we all want to win. You know what I'm saying? And that was just a part of it. And you get your dialogue with certain guys. And yeah, Rio, he loved it. But I tell you one thing, when it was time to play, he going to be there.
Every now and then I imagine an alternate universe where it's not Ray Allen who makes that shot in game 6, but it's Mario Chalmers. And I could just only imagine what that would have been like.
We would, man, he'd be selling posters right now.
if he had the NBA final shot to go with the NCAA championship shot, he would have changed his name to Mario Clutch Chalmers.
Dude. Oh, come on, bro. Come on, yeah, you got Mr. Clutch tatted on. This is the mentality of this man, you know? But yeah, if he would have made that shot, which I believe he would have made it, you know, he definitely would have made it. I'm telling you, he would have been running for president. He would have been up there with Barack.
Hey, man, Chris Bosch, check out the newsletter. It's called The Last Chip, running through the 2012-2013 season with the Miami Heat. Man, I can't thank you enough for joining us, man. Thank you so much.
Glad it worked out, man.
Absolutely, man. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Be sure to subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys next week. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.